Shifter, we are talking about laws related to mourning according to Ayatollah Sistani. Let me start this episode with this question. Is it permissible for the Muslims during the mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein or commemorating Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary every year during these times, these sad time of Muharram, to delay an obligatory prayer in order to hold a mourning ceremony?
Well, this is one of the most frequently asked questions, because it does happen that Shia Muslims, for example, are willing to hold majalis or mourning ceremonies, want to catch up with both of them, offer their prayers on time and also hold a mourning ceremony. And of course, sometimes it does happen that the mourning ceremony is held at a time when a congregational prayer should be held at the same time. Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it's not befitting, it's not appropriate for Shia Muslims to, let's say, to delay their congregational prayer. Mm-hmm. The congregational prayer or their wajib prayers, let alone congregational prayer, okay? Congregational prayer is more recommended, but okay, you are offering your wajib prayer in congregation, so you are doing an obligatory duty, and it's not appropriate for us to delay an obligatory task or duty such as prayer in order to perform a recommended act such as azadari. So in the first place, it is essential that we should arrange the azadari or the mourning ceremony in such a way that it does not coincide with the timing of the congregational prayer.
Mm-hmm. I see. The other question is that, as you know, in the month of Muharram, a lot of people donate their wealth and money for the purpose of holding gatherings and meetings to commemorate the event of Ashura during Muharram. Is it permissible to allocate this donated fund to the or for other purposes, like, for example, to the preacher, to the Quran reciter, to the elegy orator, the expenditure incurred from hosting the audience and similar avenues?
Well, sometimes you give your money during Muharram for a special purpose. Mm-hmm. You want, for example, to give food to the people who take part in the majalis.
Yes.
So that's the main purpose for the donation, okay? And sometimes you just want to contribute towards azadari.
Yes.
And the money you want to give may be spent for any purposes, for giving a portion of that money to the preacher, to the lecturer, and a portion of it for holding the other expenditures, because there are a lot of expenditures incurred during the majalis. So if you know for sure that, okay, the people, the donors, consent to spending the money for these purposes, there's no problem. But if the money has been donated for a special purpose, you cannot spend it for any other purposes except unless you get the consent and the permission of those donors or those people who contributed with their money.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Yes.
Okay.
So their permission and consent should be obtained.
I see.
In order for the money to be spent for other purposes, such as, giving some money to the lecturer or other expenditures, regular expenditures during the majalis.
Okay. Let's take a break and we'll be back and continue our laws according to Ayatollah Sistani on mourning during Muharram.
I walk in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Ooh. for you. I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get thirsty, you start to melt and say to me,
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about Muharram and the laws related to mourning and lamentation for Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, to commemorate his martyrdom anniversary. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to work and earn money on the day of Ashura?
Well, this is a very important question. Because lots of people working in the West, they should be present on their job. They should work even on the day of Ashura.
Mm-hmm.
If they do not work, then it means that they will, maybe some of them will be fired, and it will have negative consequences.
Yes,
of course, for them. So such people, of course, can continue doing their jobs and, of course, going to work. There's no objection to such people.
It's not haram, though.
It's not haram for such people. Okay,
yes.
But if I have my own job, I have my own work, and I'm free to do it,
mm-hmm.
and free to just close my shop or work and stop doing it, then Ayatollah Sistani says that if working on this day is considered a kind of disrespect,
uh-huh.
or if it amounts to disrespect for the Azadari and for Muharram, and of course it's haram to work on this day.
If it's not even reprehensible, it's haram.
Yeah, it's haram.
Unlawful.
Because
yes.
It says, because it is a tantamount to disrespect, and it means that you are not heeding Muharram. You are actually very much
respecting.
You're not respecting Muharram. You are not paying attention to Muharram, and you have no regard for Muharram. And if it is perceived as such, then it's not permissible, according to Ayatollah Sistani, to do a job, to work on this day.
Sheikh Javid, what about the studying? Like a student's studying during Ashura?
Studying, of course, in common, it's not considered to be doing a job.
Uh-huh.
No, you are studying a book. You can study books on Ashura, on Muharram, on any other topic.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's not considered a job because you are not earning money by studying.
I see.
Okay.
During Muharram, or on the night preceding the 11th day of Muharram, some people burn candles. Is it recommended to do such things, to burn candles? Is there anything in our religious literature or legacy to suggest that such a venue is recommended?
Well, there's nothing in our religious sources to indicate that, okay, burning candles or turning on or burning torches, of course, is recommended, or it is a good thing, or it's a favorable thing. Of course, it has become a custom, especially, and we see that Shia Muslims in, for example, in the Indian subcontinent, and also in Iran, they burn candles. Of course, when it comes to whether it is permissible or not, Ayatollah Sistani says that there is no objection in burning candles,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a part of the religion. There is nothing in the religion to suggest that it is recommended.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Once again, I use this opportunity to express our heartfelt condolences to our dear audiences, and may God accept all of our mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein and their pure household. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you
did take every step that you would make. Purpose and guidance it gave. Mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hossein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hossein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Today's question is a continuation of the topic we had last time, which was a very involved and deep discussion, so we'll refrain from summarizing it. But we didn't get to answer why the companions of the Imam, peace be upon him, or the Imam, why didn't he dig a well when they were prevented access to the water by the enemies? Dear Sheikh, please enlighten us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned, for 7 days, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his camp, they were able to have access to Euphrates, of course, with some problems. But then the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, Umar ibn Sa'd commanded a person to protect the Euphrates with 500 people and prevent Imam Hussein alayhi salam from reaching water and having access to the Euphrates. So why the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not dig a well so that they could have access to water? First of all, we mentioned that we should not think that, in a desert like Karbala, you only dig 4 or 5 meters and then you will have access to water. This is not the case. And now we go to the history. The history is telling us that, alhamdulillah, the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam were aware of this opportunity to dig a well. and it happened practically speaking. According to some narrations, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he dug a well some meters away from the tent, so they could not do it inside the tent.
Right.
They did it some feet away from the tent. It's been mentioned, for example, by Ibn Shahr al-Ashub in Manaqib al-Abi Talib, volume 4, page 50, and Ibn A'tham al-Kufi in Al-Futuh, page 893. So I think with that, we have answered the question.
They did dig a well.
They did dig a well.
But the water was enough? It ran out? Or?
Now, the problem is that, the point is that, Ibn A'tham al-Kufi, who has mentioned that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his companions, they did dig a well around the tent, he mentions a letter which was sent by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, the commander of Yazid in the city of Kufa and the ruler of Kufa, to Umar ibn Sa'd. Let me read you the content of the letter, which is very important. Addressing Umar ibn Sa'd, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad says that I've been informed that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his companions, they have access to water through the wells. So as soon as you, receive this letter from me, you need to prevent Husayn ibn Ali alayhi salam and his companions from digging well and having access to water through the wells. So this point is telling us that, first of all, they did dig well around the tents, and second of all, practically speaking, they were prevented also from having access to the water through the wells. So imagine there are only 72 people, and the army of the enemy, about maybe 30,000 people. So they are not able to, fight with these 30,000 people only to have access to the wells.
Right.
So as was mentioned by this command by Umar ibn Sa'd, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his companions, they were also prevented from having access to the wells.
So this well that the Imam, peace be upon him, he dug, it ran out of water, or was it not close to the tents at all? It was a bit further away.
It was a bit far from the tents, but maybe what is understood from this letter is that those soldiers of Umar ibn Sa'd, they may have been able to somehow, fill the well again with...
Exactly. They have the manpower, yeah, and they also have archers.
Yeah, that's the point.
Right.
So, as commanded by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, we came to this conclusion that for any reason, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his companions were prevented from having access to water through the wells too. So that is why we see that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, maybe they lose this option to have access to water through the wells. And then that is why we see that from time to time, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam sends some people like Abu Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam to go to Euphrates and bring water. And as I mentioned in the previous program, in some cases, they were able to bring some water skins, like in one historical report, we are told about bringing 20 water skins by 40 people. Imam Hussain alayhi salam sends 40 people.
40 people to only bring 20 water skins.
Yeah. Commanded by Abu Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam, there was a serious fight, but anyway, they were able to bring 20 water skins. It's been mentioned by, in Tariq Tabari, volume 7, page 3007, and also Maqatir al-Talibiyin, page 119, and many other sources.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio.
You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, was not neglecting the fact that they need water.
Of course not.
And one of the options was digging a well. So, according to some narrations, they did it, but then they were prevented from that. And second of all, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was forced to send some of his companions to bring water, and they did. But are they able to have access to water, free and without any fight, and to bring water as many as or as much as they wanted and they, needed? No. And they needed to fight, and they were only able to bring a few water skins, which was not enough for all those 200 people, including women and children. And as you rightly mentioned, even the horses, they needed water. And we know that it was in one of these cases that, according to some narrations, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, when he went to the river to bring some water for the people, because according to some narrations, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam asked Abbas to bring water for the thirsty kids and women, and it was through this, mission of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam, that when he was coming back, he was surrounded by the armies of Umar ibn Sa'd, and he was martyred. According to some narrations, it's been mentioned that Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas reached the Euphrates, he wanted to drink. Narrators, they say that he remembered the thirst of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, so he did not drink water. He filled the water skins with water, but on his way back, he was surrounded by the enemies, and he was martyred. So the point is that for 3 days, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions needed to fight for having water. And on the 10th day of Muharram, the day of Ashura, when fighting took place between the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, it was more difficult to have access to water, because you are fighting the enemy, and at the same time you need to go to the Euphrates and fight again to bring water. So you cannot. You need to fight in two directions. So it's very difficult.
Right.
And we know that the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam are getting martyred one after the other. So and finally, even Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam is martyred. So we cannot negate the fact that at least for the day of Ashura, for many hours, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his companions, and his family members, including women and the kids, they did not have access to water. And as I mentioned, on the land of Karbala, on that time in the year, as long as you stay, you walk, even without fighting, for half an hour, you get thirsty.
Right.
And then imagine that you are fighting with all those heavy,
Equipment, and shields, and you're running around, and you're carrying a sword, and you swing it, and
exactly.
Hitting.
So you would get thirsty very soon, and it comes to the kids, we know that they get thirsty, and they are not able to tolerate the situation. So the thirst of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his family members and his companions, especially on the day of Ashura, is a fact. And no one can deny that. Regarding digging the well, we said that according to some narrations, it was done, but they were prevented. And the last point is that we should not think that every kind of water is drinkable.
That's a good point.
Yeah. In some cases, we may think of digging a well, but then the water is not in a quality that people can drink it.
Right.
Because there is another question that reads that according to some narrations, some of the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they made a ghusl, a major ablution, before the day of Ashura, of course. So the question is that how do you claim that they didn't have access to water? They are doing ghusl.
Right.
So there are different answers. One of the answers is that it was not done during the day of Ashura for sure it was done before that. And as I mentioned, before the day of Ashura, from time to time they had access to water through fighting. And second of all, the other answer is that it's very likely that they were doing ghusl with a water which was not drinkable.
Salt water, for example.
A salt water. So we shouldn't think that that ghusl is a sign that for the whole 10 days they had access to drinkable water.
Right.
No, it was not done on the day of Ashura, which is the main point, the main scene in which the camp does not have access to water. And the second point is that it may have been done with a water which was not drinkable. Maybe they dig a well, but then the water is not drinkable, so they make the ghusl or the major ablution.
So in summary, the imam and his family and children and companions, they were all thirsty for at the very least 3 days.
Exactly.
With no drinkable water. And on that sad and very
on this, in these 3 days, from time to time, they have access water, but that water is not enough for
it's not enough for
people.
Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your time, and I thank the dear listeners for tuning in. This has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
The Light.
A French graffiti artist has created a monumental mountaintop project to encourage a more contemplative approach to life, aiming at lifting people's spirits. The giant 1,500 square meter painting is called A New Lease of Life. It was painted on the summit of Mollison Peak in the Western Swiss Alps. The 32-year-old artist says he was inspired by the likeness of childlike wonder. The mural depicts a little boy blowing bubbles in an area known for its clouds. The artist says he wanted to reflect the link between children and sky gazing.
I think we live in a world that includes anxiety, and we need a little lightness to balance it. So I believe that the clouds mean dreams and imagination. When we were kids, we liked to imagine shapes in the clouds and so on. And I believe that this is a moment where we have to breathe and also imagine the world of tomorrow with a certain lightness through daydreaming.
Saip also says he designs his creations to fit in with the environment using biodegradable paints made from natural pigments. The French artist is known for his massive graffiti works on grass that are best seen from the air. Some of his other works have adorned an impoverished shanty town in South Africa and the lawn in front of the UN headquarters in Geneva. One of Mexico's largest zoos has launched a one-of-a-kind exhibition with the star of the show being a manatee couple. Visitors will be able to see the couple at the new exhibition, which is part of the largest aquarium in the country. The zoo received the manatee couple from the Caribbean with the intention of raising awareness for the protection of the species. Part of the ticket proceeds will go towards conservation efforts. Manatees are fully aquatic, mostly herbivorous marine mammals that are sometimes known as sea cows. These funny-looking creatures are endangered because of pollution and fishing techniques.
Paleontologists in Egypt have discovered fossilized bones of an ancient whale that could probably walk on land and swim in water. Scientists found the skull, jaw, and some ribs and identified the parts as the 43-million-year-old ancestor of the modern whale. It's also the earliest type of semi-aquatic whale found in Africa. The whale is estimated to have been 10 meters in length, weighing over half a ton, and was likely a top predator. Scientists say the four-legged whale is a key new species that helps trace the transition of whales from land to sea. Paleontologists believe that the ancestors of modern whales developed from deer-like mammals living on land over a 10-million-year period. The fossilized remains were discovered in Egypt's western desert, which was once covered by sea. A French beekeeper has invented a unique device to keep his beehives safe after suffering a traumatic loss of 35 of them to hungry Asian hornets. The device is a one-way mechanism that baits hornets with sugary water, and once they get in through a funnel, they never come out. Originally, the trap was made of wooden crates and metal mesh, but now they are 3D printed in plastic. Dennis made his first lobster pot to catch the hornets in 2016 and now makes the traps in bulk due to growing demand. The Asian hornets are an invasive insect that arrived in France via a pottery shipment from China. The killer hornet can eat through an entire hive in a matter of hours. There is a festive occasion for a Mexican zoo amid a rare birth boom in its lion enclosure. Keepers and visitors are amazed to hear roars of three newborn cubs. The three baby lions that are trying very hard to roar were born just 2 weeks ago in Zacango Zoo. The zookeepers separate them from their mother for a few hours a day to feed them because their mother cannot produce milk. The two female and male cubs would live under constant surveillance for a couple of months so that their health is reassured. They are reported to be currently in good health.
A bunker built by the German army in France during World War II has now been given a new lease of life by turning it into an underground gas house. A 4,300 square feet bunker located off Breton coast in northern France was originally built by Nazi troops after invading the country in 1940. The area has been the home of hundreds of such fortifications of the German army. Half of them have been buried along sandy beaches. This underground guest house now belongs to the 52-year-old bunker enthusiast. Serge Collio says it took 18 months to dig out the buried trench and turn it into a fully functional guest house. He says an attempt was made to preserve some historic aspects during its renovation.
What is nice is to now be able to spend time here, to have dinner, to spend the night in things like this. So we adapted the bunker while preserving a certain feel. We wanted to give the building a second life, so we are not going to live in the past forever. We saved some aspects, you know, where you are, there are historic cues, but this isn't a museum either.
Collio says many French visitors and foreigners, including Germans, have stayed in the guest house since the bunker opened a year ago. The world's highest expressway has opened to traffic in China's Tibet Autonomous Region. It's nearly 300 kilometers long and has an average elevation of 4,500 meters. It connects the cities of Nanchu and Lhasa, shortening the travel time from 6 to 3 hours. The road passes through many picturesque areas, such as snowy mountains, grasslands, and wetlands. The expressway is also environmentally friendly. Special passages have been devised for animals to get from one side of the freeway to the other. An architectural firm in Singapore has come up with a unique idea to deal with the country's constant warm temperatures. A hotel on the island's busy business district has been covered with more than 20 species of creeping plants to keep the place cooler. A layer of vegetation blankets the facade of the Red Tower, which is growing thicker with the passage of time. The plants reduce the ambient temperature by a combination of water evaporation and releasing cooler vapor. The architect says the tower is 10 to 20 degrees Celsius cooler than nearby buildings. The green facades also reduce harmful carbon emissions, which account for over 20% in a spiraling city.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The youngest panda at the U.S.'s Smithsonian Zoo, National Zoo that is, has turned one. Baby panda Xiao Qiji celebrates the milestone by eating a specially made fruitsicle cake with his mother, Mei Xiang, in Washington, D.C. Both pandas dug into their icy cake, an ideal treat in the hot and humid summers of the U.S. capital. Xiao has captured hearts and had many first-time experiences. Some of them include sliding and tumbling around in snow and recognizing his name, which translates to little miracle in English.
He was born during the pandemic, and given the age of his mother, we didn't think she'd have another cub. And the fact that we, not just that we had this miracle, but he has just been, he's given people moments of pure joy and pure happiness.
Xiao Qiji is the fourth surviving cub of Mei Xiang. Its older siblings now live in China under an agreement with the United States. Pandas have been reclassified from endangered to vulnerable thanks to reforestation to expand habitats in which the species can survive. There are an estimated 1,800 giant pandas in the wild.
The annual Buddha sculpture has been unveiled at the New York State Fair to the delight of eager spectators. The artwork was sponsored for the 53rd year by the American Dairy Association. It was carved out of 400 kilograms of butter and took 10 days to build. The sculpture is dedicated to the children who will be going back to their normal lives after the coronavirus pandemic is over. Once the fair ends, all of the butter will be broken down and turned into renewable energy. Switzerland is constructing its biggest alpine solar plant in an effort to secure renewable energy throughout the year. The 2.2 megawatt plant is expected to be completed by the end of 2021. The Mutzi site will include nearly 5,000 solar modules and produce around 3.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. It will have the option of delivering half of its production during the winter when temperatures drop to sub-zero levels in Switzerland. The developers say the project makes more environmental than fiscal sense. Currently, the country gets less than 4% of its electricity from solar power. An eatery in Japan is giving disabled people a new lease on life by including them in its workforce. Dawn Cafe uses robotic staff controlled remotely by people who are handicapped. Around 50 people with mental and physical disabilities help run the cafe. The pilots come from all over Japan as well as overseas. The venue was established with support from major companies and crowdfunding. It has become more than just a place to eat for its customers.
Customers here are not exactly coming to this location just to meet the Orihime robots. They come here because of the people behind Orihime, and they will come back to see them again.
For Kentaro, Dawn Cafe has a very personal touch. In his childhood, he was left unable to go to school due to a period of bad health. Now he aspires to come up with ways to further the inclusion of disabled people in society. Crowds of visitors and conservationists have been delighted by the birth of a rare orangutan in the Spanish town of Fuengirola. The new residents of the safari park made this first public appearance 2 weeks after its birth. The baby, yet to be named, is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Bornean orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea, while five didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludvik Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years. As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
Oh, Hussein.
tried to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
One of the ways to remember Ashura that will help us be in the line of Imam al-Hussein, on the path of Ashura, on the path of Karbala, is to remember Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas. Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas is the greatest example of someone other than the 14 Ma'sumin following the 14 Ma'sumin. Remembering Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas and what he did and making that connection with him, remembering him in that way, will increase the connection that we have with Imam al-Hussein, with Karbala. It will help us remain on or join the path of Ashura and Karbala. From my reading of the narrations regarding Karbala, Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas is not seen before Karbala. Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas, I haven't seen any quotes in Medina, I have not seen any quotes in Mecca, I have not seen any quotes on the path to Kufa, I haven't seen any quotes or anything until there's Karbala. Let's analyze this. What does this mean to us? What does this tell us? What can we gather from this? What I gather from it, again, it's not only the silence there. There's something else too. I'll add, just tell you where we get this analysis of what that small line we read of the ziyarah of Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas. As-salamu alayhi ayyuhal abdu salih al-muti'i lillah wa li rasulih wa li amir al-mu'mineen. Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas tried to be like towards Imam al-Hussein, like his father was towards the Prophet. Amir al-Mu'mineen was towards the Prophet. There's a story that I think I've mentioned more than once. I don't know if you've heard it from other speakers or from myself before, but it's something to remember. Amir al-Mu'mineen was seen evidently as someone that was always in line with the Prophet, around the Prophet when he had to be, when the Prophet said, no, you're going to stay here, I'm going to go. In line with the Prophet. But this story is very interesting, where it says that one time the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi told his companions that in after Fajr prayer or fourth Fajr prayer or sometime in the morning, that they're going to meet at a certain location. Salman, which is other than the 14 Ma'sumin, at the time of the Prophet, of course, the closest to the Ma'sumin, to the extent that the hadith says, Salman minna Ahlul Bayt. Salman, while he loves Ali ibn Abi Talib, the center of attention, even for Ali ibn Abi Talib, is the Prophet. So Salman sees Amir al-Mu'mineen is always closer to the Prophet. And because of that love of the Prophet, obviously he wants to, in an effort in vain, try to compete with Ali ibn Abi Talib, in a sense. Not in a bad way. Some tried to do that in a bad way. He always saw Amir al-Mu'mineen and he tried to push himself further to get close to the Prophet the way Amir al-Mu'mineen was. So this time he goes, and while he's leaving Medina or his house or wherever the direction was, he sees one set of footsteps. And so he thinks, I got my chance. Once I was able to beat Ali ibn Abi Talib in getting to the Prophet. Then he arrived where the Prophet was. He sees Ali ibn Abi Talib is there. And he's confused. Like, there's only one set of footprints. Amir al-Mu'minin says, I follow the footprints of the Prophet. I put my feet where the Prophet puts his feet. Okay, that's how much I try to follow. This is basira. This is not blind. Some people call this blind following. Whoever calls this blind following has no idea what they're talking about. I think that would be a prime example of stupidity to call this blind following. This is not blind following. This is following based on a type of insight that Musa didn't have towards Khidr, as he is referred to in the story in the Quran. God told him, learn from him. Whatever he does, whatever he says, he goes to him and said, I'm not going to disobey you. He said, well, you're not going to be patient. First incident happened. He damaged a ship or boat they went onto. Musa disobeys. He says, the insight should have been, God said this person knows. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is like, it's like he's not there. He doesn't want to be seen. He doesn't want to say anything. The word is the word of Hussein. What he says, it's only when it's a taklif of his to come out based on what Imam al-Hussein said to do something. Like in the story you've heard, when the Mal'un Shimr came, apparently he was from the tribe or close to the tribe of their mother, that great lady Ummul Banin Salamullahi Alayha. One of the women of history, of the history of Islam, that is not remembered as she should be. The great women of the history of Islam. Some form of blood. He said, he called upon Abbas to go. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, the account says, he didn't even respond until Imam al-Hussein said, go. Said, okay. You see this as blind following? That's because if anybody does that, that's because they are blind. This is not blind following. This is insightful following. This is seeing Hussein in a way where if he says it's the time, it's the time. This takes great insight, brothers and sisters. It's important to see the conditions. And Abbas did. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas did. The very fact that he's silent, didn't even object or question, and went along to the end, never mentioning any point or even asking a question regarding this, tells you that he had full confidence in this. This tells us partially he had that insight, but the channel in getting that type of insight, brothers and sisters, is not to try to find that insight independent of the ma'soom, independent of the imam. Try to say, I see something for myself. Try to look for myself. The imam has spoken, like, okay, I want to see for myself. Leave that aside. Let me see. That's not the way you gain insight. المطيع لله ولرسوله ولأمير المؤمنين. You gain insight by listening to Allah where you don't see. When you listen to Allah where you don't see, He will show you. When you listen to Wajhullah, the Imams, When you don't see, he will show you, give you that insight to the specifics of the condition. Then you start seeing, yes, besides trusting Hussein, I see the conditions and it is exactly as he says. I see crystal clear. A person who doesn't obey the Ma'soom in this way will never be able to see in that way. Never.
Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim